This week on the show, SAG needs to suck it up, indies should look overseas too, and are we training people to be pirates? All this on This Week in Media, episode 118. Hey there, boys and girls. We are back with another edition. I am Daisy Whitney, hosting this week from TV Week and the New Media Minute. And I am all alone in the studio today. Well, I'm here with actually my sound engineer, Joe, is here with me. But there aren't any other people for me to be looking at because everyone is Skyping in today. We have guests from all around the world. And we may actually have, I might have a couple guests kind of coming in late because we've needed to change our times a little bit to accommodate some of our guests. So we're just going to kind of roll with it. But let me get started and tell you who we have here today. Keith Snow is here from North Carolina. Keith, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, Keith is a longtime listener, and he reached out to me via email a month or so ago to kind of tell me that he'd been listening to the show and to tell me a little bit about his show. He does a web series and started producing it on his own. Actually, you have a farmhouse in North Carolina. Is that correct?
Yeah, we live on a 12-acre farm, and we have a farmhouse and a barn. And the barn was actually where we started. We have a kitchen in the barn, and we got a $300 camera and started shooting videos.
And so the show is Harvest Eating, and it's all about, you know, eating local foods according to what's in season, eating with the harvest. And what's really exciting about the show, I'm very proud of Keith, is that it's going to be launching on PBS. It's going to remain a web show, but also be a television series launching on PBS stations all around the country starting in May. So that's very cool. And, you know, again, I think it's a great example. Never doubt what you can actually do on your own from a barn or a kitchen or a house or whatever it is. So, Keith, I'm glad you could join us. Now, Tim Street may be joining us. I don't know if we've got some Skype connection issues, but he may join us late. So if he does, great. We will welcome him with open arms. If he doesn't, Tim, you know you have an open invitation and we'll have you on an upcoming episode. And also Brent Friedman, who was on a couple months ago from Gemini Division, he's going to be joining us shortly. But we also have Alex here this week, so we're very excited. Alex is in Tokyo. So hi, Alex.
Hello.
Tell us, our listeners have been asking me over the last week if you could just kind of give us a quick update on, you know, what's going on with the movie and what you've been up to in Tokyo for the last week. They miss you. Your fans and listeners miss you, Alex.
No, it's we're having a great time in Tokyo. The we're working on this this movie called Memoirs of a Teenage Amnesiac, and it's based on a book, and it is a Japanese. It's for the Japanese market. But it's an American director, Hans Kanosa, and a friend of mine, Kwesi Collison, who's the visual effects supervisor, and asked me to come over and give him a bit of a hand on working on some of the visual effects. And so we're over here mostly to make sure that my primary job is to make sure that we don't bite off more than we can chew on set. It's a fascinating thing to see it. You know, you're used to the way things work in the United States.
What's the biggest difference?
I think that the biggest difference is the speed of the crew. I've never seen a crew faster than the one here in Japan. The crew is blazingly fast. Now they move faster than I think that sometimes is safe. You know, it's very, very, very quick. But they, you know, they're used to working on very short turns. They will very quickly work very, very long hours, and you don't feel any change in the speed. I was afraid that it was going to be the exact opposite. Usually the United States crews are very, you know, are fast in comparison to a lot of other countries. And that hasn't been the case here. The crew is very, 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 very quick. So that's been, you know, the big thing. And then the other thing is just dealing with, when you talk to someone, you have to remember that you can't walk over and talk to them. You have to walk over to a translator and then have the translator walk over to them. I mean, there are some people who can speak English, but a lot of the key people need a translator anytime you're talking to them. And so then there's this, you know, that's kind of the back and forth. For me, you know, it's kind of long days, but they're not, I don't, you know, we've had as long as 22 hours and as short as 12 to do shooting or, you know, 10 or 12 hours. And for me, though, it's, you know, I'm only needed for usually 3 or 4 hours of each day. So I just kind of sit on set, and it's been really great for me because I sit there and shoot behind the scenes and take photos and show the Pixel Corps what we're doing and then look at making sure that I'm ready for the next part of whatever I'm needed for. So it's been a really great experience.
Now, I'm sure you're learning a ton. Are you also able to enjoy the city at all and kind of partake in all that Tokyo has to offer?
You know, I've been getting out a little bit. We're in Roppongi, which is kind of the western. I think of it as the impression I get. It's kind of the wharf in San Francisco. it's not necessarily the classic area. It's where there's tons of bars and
that's very close to where the embassies are. So you tend to have a lot of like expat bars and great places to hang out there.
We went to a bar last night, and the DP and a couple of the crew and myself went to a bar, and the drinks were essentially like $24 a mixed drink. It was very expensive, but we got there during happy hour, of course, and so it was fine.
Alex,
but it was
do we have an advertiser that you want to tell us about?
I do have an advertiser. Our sponsor for today is Object Matrix, and Object Matrix is it's basically a low cost, high security disk based archive. So essentially, what you can do is you don't need to buy a certain type of hardware. You can have anything that you simply need to put together that you can format with what's called Matrix Store. So Matrix Store is it's really one of a great solution for Final Cut Pro. It works very, very well with Final Cut Pro server, and whether you're using tens or hundreds of terabytes, I never thought that I'd be saying we're working with hundreds of terabytes, but we have an enormous amount of storage in-house, and we're constantly burning through it. And as people start to do HD, it becomes more important. It'll sit very, very well on the Xserve platform. And the thing to remember, if you're thinking about it, is that the first 15 terabytes of storage management is free. Now you buy the hardware, so so you can get whatever you want. We've tested it with Xserves, but you can put a handful of little hard drives, Drobos, whatever you want in there. So anyway, the first 15 terabytes are free for the license, and then and you can find more information at FinalCutStorage.com. If you're dealing with lots of this and you really need, you're working on something that you really need to make sure that it's going to be there all the time, definitely check out FinalCutStorage.com for Matrix Store.
Cool. All right. Thank you. Well, we like having advertisers, so we're glad to have them. So let's get started with some of the news that's going on. And there's a lot that's going on. I don't know if we're going to be able to tackle everything, but I hope that we give you some good, useful information and insight. Now, shortly before we started recording the show, Tribune filed for bankruptcy. I just saw a New York Times alert on my cell phone. And Keith, I know you had sent me a story. I didn't read it in detail. Keith, were you able to take a look and get any details on why they're filing for bankruptcy? I mean, I think it's, falling ad revenue and challenging business models, right?
Right, bad business model and falling ad revenue and just a lot of debt, something like $11 billion worth of debt they're trying to service. So they're definitely feeling the squeeze.
So is there a sense that, does bankruptcy, could this be the thing that actually helps Tribune? I know in a lot of the conversations that people are having about the automakers, and of course, this is not a show about automakers, but the point I want to bring up is just that, certainly a lot of newspaper reports about that suggest that that's an option that the automaker should consider. And I wonder, in the case of a media company, I don't know. I'm not a bankruptcy expert. I know you guys aren't, but is the thinking that something like this could actually make the difference and help the company?
I think that it can. What it does is it allows these a company filing bankruptcy to renegotiate with the unions that are involved, renegotiate with their folks holding their debt, and really change all the rules with and that may be necessary to make the payments. A lot of times people just get to a point where the payments are just so high that there's no way you know, there's no way out of this. And so they can kind of reset that with the help of the courts. And so it's definitely possible. I think one of the challenges is going to be that with the airlines, they were they're in an industry that people keep on wanting to have, you know, and it keeps on, you know, it's growing. More and more people every year want to fly. Period. I think both the automakers and newspapers, for instance, that their big challenge is that people want less of what they make.
Right.
You know, and so the question is whether bankruptcy is going to be enough to make that work.
Well, and it goes back to, you know, the age old thing that we discuss a lot here on this show is, you know, can you convert quickly enough to a digital operation? And I don't have this story in front of me, but I read somewhere recently about how, you know, the Wall Street Journal, I mean, this is a company that has had its own share of cutbacks and whatnot and changes, especially when Rupert Murdoch took over. But they seem, you know, if memory serves, from some of the reports I've been reading, seem to be starting to figure out, you know, what that right model is for online. But of course, a lot of big media companies, you know, Alex and I were having a chat before the show started, and we kind of give away specifics of some of the, you know, smaller folks and independent folks that we know are inking really great business deals for the year ahead. But rest assured, as soon as we're able to, we're going to tell you about some really cool stuff from, you know, some of our friends and some folks who have been on the show, just about kind of smaller brands doing some really innovative things online. But a lot of the bigger media companies are the ones that are really troubled. I mean, just to sort of the layoff report is, you know, Viacom last week, reducing its workforce by 7%. NBC had a lot of layoffs as well. You know, one of the things that layoffs are not enjoyable at all, but one of the things that NBC said that it's, you know, that it's going to be doing is all executives flying to the Super Bowl will fly coach for NBC in February. And, you know, hey, maybe that's a good idea going forward. We certainly saw, again, to go back to the automakers, we certainly saw the examples of excess when they didn't even jet pool the first time they went to Congress. So, and Adobe, another company that's sort of near and dear to our hearts here at This Week in Media, laid off about 600 employees, about 8% of its workforce, and said that the layoffs are intended to help Adobe better focus on its growing online video and internet software business. And, you know, Alex, you know Adobe pretty well. What does that statement say about sort of where the future is? Online video?
Well, oddly enough, I think that it might.
I'm surprised you feel that way.
You know, I'm kind of surprised. You know, it kind of snuck up on me. I think that the online video cat is, out of the bag. and so while people can, while they have a lot of other things, they have to do more video on the web and more online video, which is a little bit different than sometimes on the web. I mean, because if you look at Adobe Media Player, iTunes, it's not really web video. It's something else, you know, but that is something that people have to now keep on, you know, keep up with, you know, and I think that I think Adobe is probably correct. I don't, you know, it's hard to lay people off, but I think it's probably correct to stay focused on that, because I think in many ways their future, and so making sure that they can stay in, you know, in that in that pocket, and make sure that they have a leadership position now. If they weren't able to invest in it, they could fall behind, and you know that could be catastrophic. You know, I think this is, you know, web video is going to be much bigger, two or three years from now. Even as a lot of other media companies, and media industries continue to contract.
Okay, so Keith, now you're somebody who has interests in both old and new media. You've got your partnership with traditional TV, with PBS, and obviously your roots are on the web. So how do you kind of look at, the layoffs and the concern about, you know, we're starting to see some independent players doing well, but some of the bigger media companies maybe not doing so well. How do you look at that from where you are?
Well, from an overall business standpoint, another thing I just read was the New York Times is leveraging the ownership in their building to secure credit because they're doubtful that they're going to be able to pay their bills. I think what's happening is those companies, even though they do embrace new media, they've got great websites, they stream video, there's just so much on the old business side that it's very difficult to close down those operations. That's why they're struggling. But for me, obviously, we started on the web. And the reason why I'm pursuing traditional TV is because there's more money in it at the moment. It took us a few years to build our brand up to where we have online videos that, you know, are enough quality where an advertiser would approach us about them. But still, I mean, we're growing our views, and it takes, as you all know, quite a long time to develop enough ad revenue and online video to pay for things. So we've shot the PBS pilot, and we've been picked up by one of the best presenting stations, because currently there's still more money in sponsorship for a PBS series than we could make just streaming ads online or doing partnerships online. So we are vested in both forms of media. We do see the future as the web progresses to be just a lot brighter than traditional TV. Plus, it's so much easier to produce stuff for the web than it is for TV, particularly PBS, which the technical requirements and the closed captioning, and because it's public television, the rules for these underwriting credits are very strict, and the companies have to put forth a very non-commercial message, and that's not right for all brands, particularly brands that are used to doing and saying what they want to build their brands online, having to then spend a good bit of money to have an underwriting credit on PBS where it's so strict isn't appealing to everybody. The thing they like is that the PBS demographic is very strong. It's a very college-educated group of people. They're a little older than the traditional web audience, so they have higher incomes. They've got vacation homes and investment accounts, so they tend to be a good demographic to market to. And that's why, you know, the PBS audience is still considered a pretty coveted audience. But then again, all the hoops you've got to jump through to do PBS definitely make it challenging. And, you know, our editors and our technical team, we're longing for the day when we can make it strictly with online video.
It's interesting. It's kind of a good reality check, because on the one hand, it's a good reminder that, yeah, you can still, you know, make a good income when you're able to have a partnership with old media. But again, on the other hand, there's a lot more that goes into it, a lot more I's that need to be dotted and T's that need to be crossed and so on. So I think that's a good point. Now, we were able to get Brent. So Brent Friedman with Electric Farm Entertainment and executive producer of Gemini Division, which I think it's concluded now, is on the show. So thank you for joining us, Brent.
My pleasure, as always.
And we're glad to be able to loop you in. So I'm glad that you're here, because something else that, that I've been wanting to chat about is the possibility of a SAG strike. So there have been, you know, who knows if it's really actually going to happen. I mean, I would just be shocked if it actually does. But it seems as if there's, you know, more and more tension and more signs that there may be one. And I just want to read you something from an LA Times story. It said, you know, in a sign of rising tensions within the Screen Actors Guild, the group representing a moderate faction of actors within the union is urging its supporters to think long and hard before casting a ballot for a strike authorization vote. SAG leaders, citing the need for leverage in negotiations with Hollywood studios, recently said they would seek strike authorization from the union's 120,000 members. So it seems from where we were at a few months ago, we might be a little bit closer. One, we still don't know. Brent, do you think there will be a SAG strike?
I think there very well could be. I think even more so than the Writers Guild or the Directors Guild. SAG has proven in the past to be a very volatile group, very unpredictable what they're going to do. I think, you know, how it's going to affect, you know, online video, I can only speak personally. You know, when we started this business of Electric Farm about 2 years ago, and we did Afterworld, everything was a gray area with regards to, you know, using SAG and online video and digital media. And so we were able to kind of fly under the radar with Afterworld and really didn't worry about it. We used some SAG actors and some non-SAG, and it really... It wasn't an issue at all. When we were doing Gemini, in particular, because we had Rosario Dawson in it, there was she was obviously SAG, and there was a lot of people that we cast around her who were SAG. And in the course of producing that show, we ended up making a deal with SAG. And I think going forward, we've more or less built our business around having real quality talent in front of the camera.
And so by having a deal with SAG, does that mean all of your shows you will use SAG talent for?
Yes. Okay. I mean, I can speak for sure about the next two or three, knowing who we've cast in them. They all will be SAG. And I think at this point, our attitude is, you know, Electric Farm has made agreements with the WGA, the DGA, and SAG, and we're looking at ourselves as a digital studio who's working with the best talent we can afford to make deals with. And so if there is a SAG strike, it's going to affect us pretty much the same way it does all of the networks and studios.
So how damaging would an actor strike be for entire entertainment industry, and then specifically for companies like yours, Brent?
I think it would be hugely damaging to the entertainment industry at large. I think, you know, based on a number of meetings I've been in and various surveys and studies I've seen over the course of the last 3 months, the effects of the Writers Guild strike are still being felt. And I think you couple that with a really bad economy. I think a SAG strike, particularly a prolonged one, could could be disastrous. It could just be another nail in the coffin. For our company in particular, I think it might force us to reevaluate our strategy to a certain degree.
Your strategy in terms of who you cast, or just your strategy as a company?
Well, both. I mean, those two things are intertwined at the moment.
Right, true.
You know, we're trying to produce higher end content, and I don't. It's not to say that ours is better, but we're trying to put more production value. We're trying to have higher budgets so that we can tell stories with a little bit more kind of epic quality, and in order to achieve that, it's not unlike trying to go get a large feature film financed. You need a name in it. The other thing about getting a name is that if you get the right one, you're getting someone who's probably very good. So it's just another aspect of trying to increase the production value. All of those things provide a certain level of comfort for brands when we go out to get sponsorship integration deals, and as well as in terms of promoting the show and getting publicity for the show. It certainly helps to have someone like Rosario Dawson attached to it. For our upcoming show, John Heater, that's part of our business model at this point. That's allowing us to make the quality, production value quality of content that we are.
Now, your new show is it Woke Up Dead?
Yeah, we're.
And when does that launch?
We're in pre-production on Woke Up Dead, which is starring John Heater. It'll be like Gemini, about 50 episodes, probably 4 to 5 minutes long. And, we start shooting, I think, in early February.
Do you have a partner like you had NBC for Gemini Division?
Well, originally we made a two-project deal with NBC for Gemini Division and Woke Up Dead. And as we got into the process of Gemini Division, we started to realize that on Woke Up Dead, the audience for that show, because it's a black comedy, was really more web-centric than something like Gemini Division, which had more what we perceived to be kind of mass appeal, more mainstream appeal. So we ended up making just an exclusive deal. Well, not exclusive, that's the wrong word, but we made a primary portal deal with YouTube as our domestic partner on Woke Up Dead. And then we've gone ahead and done what we did on the other two shows, which was made an international distribution deal with Sony Picture Television.
And I think, it's interesting. I think that the international distribution deals, I mean, Michael Eisner's company, Vuguru, did that with Prom Queen. I mean, those are things, I mean, you're obviously connected in Hollywood, and I think Michael Eisner's got a few connections too. But those are really interesting models to look at. And I think this goes back to, things we've talked about on this show that just kind of everybody needs to be thinking of, whether you're, an independent producer, whether you're somebody, whether you're a Keith and, you've had some success, starting to cross over, whether you're a big media company, whether you're just a business person, an entrepreneur starting up a company. It's the whole idea of, multiple revenue streams and finding out, what those are for your company. If you're a company seeking venture capital, I mean, VCs are telling me these days that that's what they want to see. They want to see that, a company is going to make more money with more than just ads per se. And what you're talking about is, the international licensing, I think, is a real I don't know if it's sort of maybe an opportunity that's just starting to be tapped into when it comes to web video and to online shows. And, you know, I've had a few companies write to me and say, you know, hey, we're based out of the States and we're really looking to license, you know, as many U.S. shows as possible to distribute here. So it's interesting. I mean, this seems that there's sort of a whole, I mean, do you think that's kind of an untapped opportunity? I mean, you're obviously tapping into it, Brent, but do you think that's an opportunity that other producers could start pursuing more, or then they'd take all of the money from you potentially? Maybe we don't want them to do that. Let's just keep it a secret.
Yeah. No, you know what? It isn't a secret. It shouldn't be a secret. I think it's a bridge that every content producer should at least consider. And it's probably not right for every producer. In our circumstance, again, we're kind of at the high end in terms of budgets. So we have to look for two things that are very intertwined, which is, one, we have to look for as many revenue streams and as great a possibility to monetize as we can. And secondarily, tied into that, is we have to look for the most exposure in terms of getting our content out. And as I'm sure you know, or you've probably heard from many people, one of the most difficult things on the internet is to market, you know, to publicize, to get people to know about your show, when to see it, when to find it. You know, it's extremely difficult. You know, Hollywood has spent decades now perfecting how to market a big feature film or a new TV show, but in terms of how to do it in the digital space, it's all still kind of a mystery.
Have you cracked the nut on that at all?
Well, no. I mean, I would say no. I wish we had. I think one of the things that we have found, though, is that the internet is a big, international, a spontaneous event that's happening every moment. And to try and have a piece of content that gets released here in the States and somehow finds its way to every nook and cranny of that huge international digital space, leaving that to chance is not necessarily the best business bet. What Sony gives us is the ability to use their vast infrastructure and their expertise in selling television and other types of content all over the world in every territory. So they're able to go in and they essentially have established relationships in every territory, large and small, outside of the U.S. And what they can do is go in and make very specific kind of a la carte deals for our content in each territory that includes its own kind of versioning of the content so that more people in each territory can see it. And then it comes with a lot of kind of what I'll call indigenous marketing plans and sponsorships within those territories. For us to be able to try and pull that off would be impossible. We would be spending much more time marketing and distributing our show than we would producing it, which is not feasible at the moment. So I think, you know, that's what Sony gets us. Now the trade-off, and this is why I say everyone has to cross this bridge, it's not a simple decision, is that in some ways you're defying the power of the internet, which is that it wants to, anything that comes out on the internet wants to be a massively international communal event. You want to be able to put something up and have people from all over the world talk about it.
I mean, I think that there were some, I mean, I heard from, you know, we have a lot of listeners in other countries and they wrote and like, well, why can't we see Gemini Division here? Why can't we see it in Germany? Or why can't we see it in Canada? I mean, that it goes to what you're talking about. I mean, that's kind of the double-edged sword, right?
Yes. I mean, we've been called fascist and racist and all sorts of things.
Fascist, I think that was the term.
For denying our friends and fans all over the world access to the content. And that is the trade-off. You don't have... Well,
I think one of the things is that I just have to say, I'm in Japan, so I have a right now. And I got that taste firsthand. Where Hulu and a lot of other stuff, you know, I couldn't watch anything. But I think that the problem that you get into is, of course, I solved that problem in about 20 minutes.
Would you find some kind of workaround? I mean,
it's called Hotspot Shield. And so what it does is it shields your IP. And so, and of course, you know, I complained about it on Twitter, and I had like 20 suggestions in about, you know, within minutes.
That's what I love Twitter for.
And installed this hotspot shield, and then I was watching all the U.S. shows again. You know, and the thing is, I think that's one of the challenges that that a lot of this stuff has. It's not so much that people should or shouldn't do that, but it's that this is the media is very hard to control. You know, I mean, you know, once you, you know, I think that the problem that Hollywood is going to have continually is this attempt to control the content to a point where you're going to try to control, even people are trying to control the content. And this is what's, in my opinion, sometimes going to cause a lot of trouble because they're not getting revenue where they could. And maybe it's less revenue, but, you know, people will, you know, try to find the content wherever they can get it. And a lot of people are happy to pay for it if it's easy to find. You know, I mean, that's the reality. You know, there's stuff that, you know, I have. Now, is your stuff available? Do you have anything on iTunes?
Gemini Division was released domestically on iTunes as well as a number of other places.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to add, Alex, that we recently signed a distribution agreement for international, which tends to be pretty difficult with PBS. But we found a company in New Jersey called Janssen Media. And they now represent the Harvest Eating PBS series internationally. So they, right. They've been doing that for about 20 years, and they travel to all the, you know, big conferences, MIFCOM and those types of places. So we've tried to bring in any revenue streams we can with the show, and the international one. I mean, for a first season on PBS to have the show international is a pretty good situation, so we're looking forward to what that could bring.
Where is that being marketed to, Keith? Do you know what countries are pitching that to?
Well, they were just in Cannes, France at MIPCOM, and I guess there's just about every country there buying PBS, but they're telling me that Japan, South America, European countries are ones that they have a good bit of success selling into, so we expect a lot of placement.
No, that's it. And now what? Now that's for your TV show. Would there be any way of the web show having sort of an international deal too, or do you feel that's already kind of universally available?
Well, yes, I would say it is. I mean, we've got people that email and watch what we do on the web in, boy, every corner of the globe, and people aren't afraid to write in, and whether they reach us on harvesteating.com or our YouTube page or Facebook, whatever, they ask a lot about the recipes and videos, and, you know, they're looking for culinary advice. So it is global. I don't know how we'll monetize, you know, some of the global stuff, but this international TV distribution seems to be a good situation for us. So we're kind of excited about it.
Well, yeah, I think that you know, it makes or breaks a lot of shows. You know, international distribution. I think that's what's important is that it comes out at the same time. So I think like the direction that you're going down there makes a lot of sense. It's just that what you can't have is a lot of people who can't get it. You know, if they hear about something that they're excited about, they will find it. And I think that we you know, oftentimes risk. If people can't get it and they get used to going somewhere that isn't iTunes or Hulu or whatever, they you know, they start BitTorrenting it. It's hard to get them out of the habit.
Right. We're training people to be pirates. I mean, Brent, do you worry about that at all?
Well, you know, it's how do I say this? It is a problem, and there's a false sense of security, I think, that to a degree that comes from using the latest technologies to geo-protect or geo-block your content to try and create some sort of exclusivity with regards to each territory it's released in. I mean, everybody knows that, you know, as Alex said, there's ways around it. The good news we found is that the vast majority of people just wait for it to come to their territory. There's still
a
fairly
force.
Small percentage of people that are actually, you know, taking the time to go figure out how to get it. I mean, you know, but that said,
I'd agree. I mean, I spend a lot of time overseas and in countries and, you know, in Africa, you know, you can get a movie that was released 3 days ago, you know, in the United States on DVD. You know what I mean? And so,
I'm sure it's a great copy too.
Some of them are, some of them aren't. You know, it was I did kind of a sampling of them in one country and just to see what was there. You know, and it wasn't even new ones; it was stuff that I already had, and I just wanted to see. And some of them are shot over some guy's shoulder, and some of them are, you know, DVD screeners, things that are, you know, pretty much as good a quality as you can get on a DVD. So it's a vast range of how that works. You know, a lot of times the digital version of these movies or shows or whatever are floating around, you know, and as soon as they're in digital form, you know, they can be moved. And there are, I guess, a handful of people who work at some of these facilities that can make them move. So...
No, piracy, of course, and, you know, making something available everywhere, it's sort of one of those ongoing overhang issues, if you will, that I think is, you know, we haven't quite figured it out, haven't quite, you know, solved it by any stretch of the imagination for the television or the entertainment industry. So I think it's very much in motion. Something else I wanted to make sure we touch on, I know we're a little bit tight on time, but I really want to have a quick conversation about Google and TV ads. Now, Google has this Google TV ads platform introduced a year or two ago, and Google has deals with EchoStar, with NBC Universal, and just last week with Hallmark Channel. Obviously, Hallmark Channel is a smaller cable channel. I'm not saying this is some sort of landmark deal, but you know, this is Google we're talking about, and you know, it's continuing to add inventory partners to the system. And I guess what I want to do is kind of think a little bit futuristically here. I mean, this whole idea of an auction model, and you know, what you can really do with the Google TV ad system is, you know, you can target by day part. You can really look at, you know, in real time how your ads are performing. You can tweak it on the fly. You know, I could update, you know, today and have my ads reflected in that updated fashion, you know, 24 hours later tomorrow if I were an advertiser. So I guess I'm just wondering what you guys think. Is this, do we envision a day when Google runs all of the ads on TV? I know my editor at TV Week loves to talk about that concept. I mean, come on, isn't Google going to be running all of television? Alex, Keith, well, Brent, what do you guys
think?
I think that
it's a very, very efficient ad model. And I think that there is a entrenched community that runs advertising right now, in my opinion. But and that's going to be Google's hurdle is that, you know, it's just that it's not just done on a computer. It's done with lots of people talking to lots of people and people having drinks and chatting about what they're going to do and so on and so forth for a lot of the big buys. But at the same time, the Google's advantages is that, you know, it brings some of the advantages of the web to TV. And I think that's, you know, the accountability, being able to be flexible, being able to be much more targeted, as it grows, it could have, I think, a huge impact.
Keith, what do you think? Is the Google TV ad system, you know, one of the things that's going to continue to upturn the old media business and make it have to change even faster?
Well, part of it seems like it's, you know, a backwards looking theory that they have. I mean, with everything moving to the web, for them to invest in staff and roll this big thing out where they're having people, instead of buying ads online, buying them on traditional TV, it's interesting to me. But again, I think what they do is they bring the power to the people, because how many ad agencies want to deal with, you know, a $5,000 media buy? I mean, it's generally something that they're not overly interested in. They want, you know, long-term campaigns and better paying campaigns. But this way, you know, I think what Google's ultimate goal is to reach out to the small and medium-sized business, where there's, you know, tons and tons more of those compared with big media brands that have the power to spend a lot of money on TV. And they're going to serve up TV to those small and mid-sized businesses. I think it's very smart. As long as advertising on TV stays a viable format, they'll probably do it well, because they seem obviously to be efficient at doing these type of things. I actually saw that pop up in my, you know, Google console the other day, and I checked it out, and it's pretty incredible.
Did you toy around with it? Like, did you just kind of play around with the system a little bit?
Yeah, I asked it to, you know, search for different times, and, you know, it lists when you can buy the ads, what shows, all different hours of the day, and it's pretty cool what they have. I mean, if we were the type of business that could benefit from that, I'd be interested in it myself.
I wonder if all advertising is just going to start getting smaller in a way. I mean, it's, you know, Alex, I know, you know, you've talked a lot about how you think that there are, you know, opportunities for brands themselves to be making web shows? And, you know, if Google makes more inroads, which it probably will, it is Google. And you know, we heard certainly, you know, search has opened up advertising opportunities for many small companies that never could have advertised before, you know, and we're seeing the bigger companies really struggling a lot right now. I mean, to ad buys start getting smaller, and I don't mean just, you know, the dollar size getting smaller because of economic problems, but I just mean, you know, seeing just, you know, just even larger range of companies getting into it with, you know, incrementally smaller buys, but maybe that, you know, add up. I don't know.
Well, I was talking to someone last night who was actually working on a series. He's been working on the same ads every year for, you know, 4 years. And he said he watched it go from 100%, you know, TV commercials to, you know, 80%, you know, TV to, you know, now it's 50-50, you know, TV and web, where they're spending their money. And you know, the next step, he's wondering when they're going to ask if they can just repurpose the web content to TV. You know, it's moving, you know, each year there's just a more and more money is flowing into the web because it's more accountable. It needs the things that, you know, people are getting, you know, as soon as they start seeing the web and they start seeing numbers. You know, I think for ad people, being able to see who's watching it and if they watched it and what their demographic is, and really having that information in theoretically real time at some point in time is you know, heroin for an ad guy, you know. And so I think that there's a huge push for that. And I also do think, as you were saying, is that a lot of these companies are finding that they can make their own content. And I think that, you know, we're seeing a lot of companies starting to do more and more of that. The bang for the buck that they can get is oftentimes more direct. And I think that it's more measurable for them of seeing people that are really coming up. I mean, you can see stuff like that with the Holiday Inn Express smart guy, you know, smart show.
Right.
Of them experimenting with, you know, a lot of that. And they, you know, they've considered that very successful. Now, that's still produced in a very Hollywood type of way. I mean, I think that they have a Hollywood production company that kind of puts it together. And it's still what I would consider probably, you know, Hollywood prices for a lot of this stuff. But it's still a lot less expensive than an ad campaign. And I think that we're going to see more and more companies kind of going in that direction.
And look, hey, Hollywood is not all bad. I like a lot of pop culture stuff that comes out of Hollywood. So, gosh, you know what? We really do need to wrap things up. There's so many other interesting things going on in the news, and I apologize to the listeners if we're giving you short shrift. But like I said, we have some, you know, sort of weird timing things this week. So I'm just going to go around and have everybody tell us where we can find you online. Keith, where can we find you online?
You can find me at harvesteating.com, also on Facebook. And certainly Twitter, it's at Chef Keith Snow. And come and see me and check out my videos and recipes and tell some friends.
Cool. All right, Brent, where do you want people to find you these days? Gemini Division's over. Where should we be looking for you?
Well, Gemini Division is over in the sense that the 50-episode run has ended on the, you know, NBC suite of portals.
That's true. But it does live forever. It is the web.
Yes, but it is it's still up right now on at GeminiDivision.com, and I think within the next week we'll be launching officially on YouTube.
Oh, okay, great.
Yeah, and maybe some other portals as well. And the show has just started to roll out internationally. Australia is now live with Gemini Division, and there'll be a whole slew of territories coming online soon.
And now the great thing, if somebody starts tuning in now, is they can see everything. If you get addicted to the show, you can just have a Gemini marathon. Real quick, Brent, are you able to share anything in terms of how the show did? I mean, was any metrics measurement at all?
Well, the actual numbers are going to be released as NBC's compiling them, I believe, in early January. But what we've been told from them in a number of different ways is that they were very happy with the release. And, you know, when the show first came out, you know, my personal barometer of success was that, you know, the show would build an audience over the course of its run. And that's exactly what happened. They ended up, you know, having more people at the end watching the show than we started off with. So that to me means that the story was working. You know, all of the numbers and whatnot, I'll be really curious to see what they are. I know that one of the biggest surprises that I can share with you is how well it did on VOD. I think everyone thought that was just going to be kind of an afterthought, you know, in terms of a platform, but it did amazingly well in VOD, particularly as compiled episodes. You know, the way the show was designed, we could release it as singular episodes, or we would combine or compile four episodes to create a kind of a larger episode. And in that format, the show in HD, the show did very well.
Well, this is all good because I think you do great work, and I want you to be able to keep doing great work. So I'm glad that it's a success. And of course, Alex, we know where to find you on Twitter.
On the Twitters. I'm on the Twitters.
That's where Alex is. And you can find, you know, you can read my stories on TVWeek.com. And I want to urge everyone, if you get a chance, to check out my TV Week column this week. I, you know, Twittered about it on, you know, Monday. So if you follow me there, you can find it there. You can just go to TV Week, because I had kind of a fun column where I compiled a lot of my ideas and thoughts from, you know, from Twitter followers on when is the socially acceptable time to reveal spoilers about TV shows on Twitter and or other social media forums. So you can read the column and take a poll on, you know, when you think is the appropriate moment. And I just want to put one more thought out there for the listeners. This is purely selfish, so, you know, so there you go. I'm looking into new distribution partners for the New Media Minute for 2009. Of course, it's still going to be on TV Week and abcnews.com, but it's also going to be carried on Jugular Advertising's blog. So if there are sort of like-minded, you know, websites or bloggers that, you know, just want to embed it every single week, email me and let's talk about it, because, you know, I'm like everybody, I want to grow my audience. So there you go. We are over and out.